From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The rise of the West transformed the world. The rise of Asia will bring about an equally significant transformation. So begins Kishore Mahbubani's new book, The New Asian Hemisphere. Mahbubani is Singapore's former ambassador to the United Nations, and his book is an argument for why Asia will rise and how the West must adjust to that transformation. As he notes, three out of the four largest economies in the world by the year 2050 will be China, India, and Japan. And those in the West best not ignore that reality. The New Asian Hemisphere, our topic next on Forum, after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Critics of President Bush often say that America will be viewed more positively as soon as he leaves office. But how America and the West are viewed by the rest of the world is obviously a more complex question than just who resides at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. In his new book, The New Asian Hemisphere, Singapore's former ambassador to the United Nations, Kishore Mahbubani, argues that the West must come to terms with the inevitable rise of the East. It is futile for the 12% of the world's population who live in the West, he writes, to imagine they can determine the destinies of the remaining 88%. How will Asia's rise impact the West? What does it mean for trade, for our economy? What about matters of global warming and global peace? The time has come, Mahbubani writes, for the West to consider the possibility that other nations and communities are as competent, if not more competent, in managing global and regional challenges. Kishore Mahbubani is also dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy in Singapore, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us. One of the points that you make early in the book is that while those of us in the West think about the West as being dominant and that's the way it's always been, in some ways it's a bit of an anomaly of history that if you go back over the last several thousand years, in fact, it wasn't always that way.
Yes, absolutely. If you look back over the last 2,000 years, from the year 1 to the year 1820, the two largest economies of the world were consistently China and India. And it's only in the 19th century, essentially, after 1820, that first Europe took off and then America took off. And so what we are going to see in the 21st century is not a deviation from the norm. It's a return to the norm of the last 2,000 years. And so therefore, those who are skeptical of the rise of Asia should see it as the return of Asia to the natural place it has had for 2,000 years.
And why is that return, why is that rise of Asia inevitable, beyond just the fact that that may have been the historical norm? Mm-hmm. Why are you convinced that that inevitably will return?
Well, what I say in the book is that, you know, the Asians have finally understood the seven pillars of Western wisdom that they had to implement in their societies. I'm not sure whether you know this, but my first book was called provocatively, Can Asians Think? And the reason I wrote that book is I asked my Asian friends, you know, if you were on top of the world in the year 1000, what happened to you in the year 2000? Why are you so behind? Clearly, Asia fell behind the West for centuries. Now, finally, it's clear that the pillars of Western wisdom, including free market economics, mastery of science and technology, rule of law, education, culture of peace, all these things, the Asians are finally beginning to implement in their societies. And if you look at the performance of Asian students in universities, especially in North America, it's very clear that Asian minds are as good as anybody else's. So it's somewhat unnatural that the countries with the world's largest pools of brain power which is as good as any other society's, has been so underused for the last 200 years.
You write a fair amount about China in the book, India, of course, as well. And you talk about what Deng Xiaoping did in particular and cite him as someone who understood that economy had to change, that economic reform had to precede political reform. Talk some about what happened in China, what set forth that transformation.
Well, I think Deng Xiaoping will go down as the greatest leader of the 20th century. Because if you look at it, you know, the
despite the human rights concerns and all of the rest of the political
despite
objections
human rights
you could
concerns
make,
yeah. and all. In fact, that's a very good point that you just raised. Because most Western discourse on China is so politically correct that it often misses the big picture completely. You know, the British used to have a school of thought called the utilitarian philosophers. And they say that the measure of goodness is simply by the amount of human happiness that you create. Now, Deng Xiaoping created more happiness in China than any other Chinese leader ever did. There were 600 million people living less than a dollar a day in China. And after his reform started, we are now down to 200 million people. Can you imagine that 400 million people, larger than the population of America, have been lifted up from living on less than a dollar a day? And what was brilliant about Deng Xiaoping is that even though he had spent most of his life, virtually all his life as a communist, you know, believing in central planning, once he saw that every society around China, from Japan to South Korea, from Taiwan to Hong Kong, from Singapore to Thailand, every society around China was doing better than China. He said, what's wrong? What do we need to do about it? So he clearly said, we've got to switch. So he made a 180-degree switch from central planning economics to free market economics. And he justified it with a brilliant phrase, you know. He said, it doesn't matter whether a cat is black or white. If it catches mice, it's a good cat. So he went from the black of central market economics to the white of free market economics and say, let's see whether it catches mice. And it did.
The Western objection, though, still might be that it matters what the cat is like. It's not enough that the cat just catch the mice. The cat must also be concerned about these other values of human rights and personal freedom.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. But the history of the world, indeed even the history of the West, teaches us that no society becomes democratic overnight. The United States spoke of the concept of equality of man in the 1770s and then took 100 years to get rid of slavery, took 150 years to give the vote to the women, and almost 200 years to give the vote effectively to the black population of America. If you look at the history of America itself, it's clear that these things happen slowly over time. And the same things will happen in China too. But here, let me make a very important point that I think every Western audience should be aware of, you know. There was a time when the rest of the world would listen to lectures from the West on human rights and freedom and say, okay, you know, maybe we don't like these lectures, but they have a right to lecture us. Their practices on human rights and freedom are much better than ours. But I can tell you that after Guantanamo, after the United States, to the shock of everybody in the world, became the first developed country to practice torture again, the Chinese intellectuals would say to me, Kishore, before Guantanamo, we would listen to American lectures on human rights and freedom, disagree with them publicly, but in private, in our hearts, we said, right, the Americans are right. They are better than us. But they said, after Guantanamo, their response is, what's the difference? You beat up people, we beat up people, and in your case, you are a far more developed society, you have a far less justification to do so, so please don't lecture us.
Mm-hmm. Kishore Mahbubani, our guest this hour, his new book is called The New Asian Hemisphere. On the point of Iraq, which you just referenced in some ways, you make the point also in the book that Iraq serves as an example of how the West just doesn't understand Asia and the East, that the fundamental folly of it, I think are your words, come from that fundamental misunderstanding.
Absolutely. You know, in the last 200 years, the West has got used to seeing the rest of the world as essentially being either very passive populations or passive societies. And the West, frankly, had the power to intervene. Initially, the power of intervention came in the form of colonization and then occupation and then, of course, domination, even after the decolonization period. And to me, it's absolutely astounding, you know, that extremely well-educated, well-informed people in the Bush administration actually believed in their hearts of hearts that an army of Christian soldiers landing in an Islamic country in the 21st century would be welcomed with flowers. Now, what were they smoking? You know, seriously, I mean, how could they possibly believe that, given the fact that that the West had already angered the Islamic world so much? How could they possibly believe it? You know, I told a story in my previous book, Beyond the Age of Innocence, Rebuilding Trust Between America and the World. I was in Xi'an, China, in the heartland of China, visiting the oldest mosque in China, and we were greeted by a Han Chinese imam. And I emphasize that he did not come from one of the minority groups in China. This is a main Han Chinese imam. As we left the mosque, he said to us 6 months before the invasion of Iraq, he said, when you're going back to New York, please take a message back to President Bush. Tell him, please don't invade Iraq. Enough Muslims are being killed around the world. Now, if a Han Chinese Muslim can feel that enough Muslims have been killed, can you imagine how 1.2 billion Muslims felt when once again a Christian army landed on Islamic soil? How could the West not see that? How is it that so few voices in America spoke out against the war? How is it so many of them were afraid to speak the truth?
And is the answer to your question, in your judgment, in part because we fundamentally don't understand, don't think about, don't visit, don't comprehend the rest of the planet?
Absolutely. See, what the main problem about the Western mind is that because it has dominated world history for 200 years, and as I mentioned in the book, this era of Western domination of world history is going to come to an end, but not the end of the West. The West will remain the single strongest civilization for 100 years or more. But what the West needs to do is to give up its black and white view of the world and begin to understand that we are moving into a world of far greater complexity with many shades of grey. And you must learn to be like the Eskimo who can see several grades of white in the snow. Mm. And in the world that you just saw as black and white, now it's a very different world. And the populations that were passive are now going to insist that they have an equal say in the running of the world. And frankly, if you believe in the Western principles of democracy and equality, then it's time that the 88% of the world's population should be given their rightful place in the management of the world's affairs.
Kishore Mahbubani, again, his new book, The New Asian Hemisphere. On that point, I think there is often, when you talk about the rise of China or the rise of India, there's a certain fearfulness to a degree in the West over that phenomenon. You make the point in the book that we shouldn't be fearful, those of us in the West, and that the push towards modernity brings with it enormous benefit, not just to Asia, but to the entire planet, in part because with modernity comes the rule of law, comes peace.
Indeed, the best news of my book for both America and Europe is that I've been to Europe, They live in terror of Islam, in great fear of Islam. They feel that the Islamic world is a dark force about to engulf the West. Now, in opposition to that dark, pessimistic view, I propose a very bright, optimistic view that the march to modernity that began with Japan, went to the Four Tigers, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, went to Southeast Asia, marched into China, marched into India, is now poised to enter the Islamic world too. And the cover of my book does not show a picture of Shanghai. It shows a picture of Dubai. Mm-hmm. Now, if the experiment of modernity of Dubai and other such states can succeed, you will see essentially an Islamic middle class emerging, which wants to have exactly the same thing that a European middle class or an American middle class wants.
And you also make the point that modernity can be measured and its eventual impact in terms of peace and the rule of law in small things, things like cell phones and flush toilets.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in the West, modernity is now associated with very exotic things, you know, like an Andy Warhol painting, for example, you know. Whereas for most Asians, modernity is associated with very simple things. And you're right to mention flush toilets. I grew up in a home in Singapore when I was a child, which didn't have a flush toilet. We had a metal bin that was cleared every 24 hours. And I can tell you that when at the age of about 10, when we went from that to a flush toilet, I felt that my life improved by 100% at least. And if you look around, the vast majority of the world's population still does not have access to flush toilets.
So, I mean, not to be facetious about this, but in a sense, are you making the argument that the greatest thing we could do to promote world peace would be to have more flush toilets, to focus on things that make a basic difference in the way people feel about the quality of their lives?
Absolutely. And the tragedy is that it can be done, you know. When you look at the amount of money that the West has claimed that it has given out in development aid, all that money should have been enough to buy one flush toilet per household around the world. But as you know, as I mentioned in the book, the story of Western aid to the world is a story of a big myth. So I think about 80 cents of every dollar that is supposedly going to a developing country goes back to the donor country for administration expenses, for consultants, for use of corporations, and so on and so forth. And that's a great tragedy. Indeed, the really good news is that the Asians now realize that the secret of development is that you've got to take charge of development yourself. And the fact that Asians are succeeding is now sending a clear message to the Africans, to the Arabs, and to the Latin Americans that we too can succeed. We too can develop. And, you know, I emphasize the point, the first step you've got to take towards development is to first of all convince yourself that you can do it. And for centuries, because the West dominated the world so much, the rest of the many Indians, for example, believed that India could never become a developed country in the 19th century. Today, most Indians are convinced that they can do better than the West. And that's a remarkable psychological shift.
Some of what you write about reminded me, as I was reading it, about the story that one of the best things the United States did was after the tsunami happened several years ago, that the amount of aid that did directly get to people in need in Indonesia and in other Muslim areas made a huge difference in how the West was viewed. And it reminds one, in a sense, then, of why it's so unfortunate, really catastrophic, that Iraq, the rebuilding of Iraq, has not happened, because people, in a sense, don't feel any more safe, don't feel any more modern or any less likely to have the rule of law brought to them.
You're absolutely right. You know, as you know, I have two very painful chapters for a Western reader in the book. One is called De-Westernization, and the other chapter is on Western incompetence. And I can tell you the rest of the world is amazed at how incompetent the invasion, by the way, was competent. The occupation was completely incompetent of Iraq. And, you know, the story of occupation has been going on for 2,000 years. And to begin by completely demolishing the state administration of Iraq obviously was a disaster. And clearly your story of the tsunami is also absolutely right. In fact, I do believe, by the way, that there is still in the world, despite the high amounts of anti-Americanism in the world, there are many people out there who still realize that on balance, America has also done a lot of good things. And I think America can recover a lot of the pro-Americanism it has lost by just beginning to do simple, sensible things. Like, for example, the help it gave in the tsunami in Indonesia. It helped a lot.
Let's talk about some of the issues that are now coming up in the American presidential campaign and how they tie in to some of the topics you address in your book. Free trade is one. If you listen to any of the presidential debate, that topic comes up. There is a desire, perhaps in this country, certainly in Europe, for a degree of protectionism. How do you think the West should respond to the question of trade in terms of how it will not only help Asia but provide more world stability?
Well, I think if you want the simplest explanation of why the world economy today is growing faster than it ever has in 2,000 or 3,000 years, it's because the whole world has bought the idea that free trade is good for the world. And the greatest danger we face today is that, you know, free trade was essentially a gift from the West to the rest of the world. And initially, as you know, when I was a young diplomat, the developing countries, you know, in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, thought that free trade was a trick that the West was trying to play on the developing world by getting them to open up their economies so that the Western companies could come in and rape the developing economies. That was the perception of free trade in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
And some of that, to a degree, certainly happened.
Yeah.
Certainly happened through colonialism, certainly happened in Latin America.
Yes, but now, paradoxically, the Asians accept the fact that free trade is good for the world because, you know, Adam Smith was absolutely right. That's how you create a better economy. Now, the problem we have today is that the custodians of the international trade processes are still the Western countries because they dominate global institutions. But the greatest believers in free trade are now in Asia. But the West refuses to give up its custodian of these great global institutions while it is losing faith in free trade. But I think the critical thing that I think that needs to be done in the West now, ironically, Asians now have to persuade the West that free trade is good for the West. Because I believe in the long run, all societies will benefit because the global economic pie is growing.
And does that apply also to the question of agricultural subsidies, not only within the European Union, but in this country too, and that changing that would have a great benefit in terms of, again, this rise of modernity, not only in Asia, but in Africa?
Absolutely. I mean, if you know, when I talk of geopolitical incompetence of Europe, for example, you know, it's very obvious that on the small continent of Europe, with an aging population and a youth deficit, and if you're right next to the continent of Africa with a youth surplus, inevitably you're going to attract illegal migrants into Europe unless you find a way of creating jobs in Africa. And ironically, the common agricultural policy, which spends enough money to fly every European cow around the world on business class 5 times and give them sufficient money to buy duty-free shopping. I mean, that's the absurdity of the amount of money they're spending on European cows. They could use that money to create jobs for Africans and prevent the illegal migration into Europe. So the inability of the European Union to think long-term about its policies and the impact of something like the Common Agricultural Policy on the long-term destiny of Europe shows how much policies in Europe, and to some extent in America, are just driven by short-term electoral considerations.
Kishore Mahbubani, our guest, his book again, The New Asian Hemisphere. When we come back, we'll take your calls as well as we pursue this idea about the rise of Asia, the rise of modernity, and why that's good for the rest of the world. Here's our number if you'd like to join our conversation. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us now at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. Back with more from Kishore Mahbubani in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, the former ambassador to the United Nations from Singapore, Kishore Mahbubani. His new book is called The New Asian Hemisphere, The Irresistible Shift of Global Power to the East. Take your calls in just a moment, and we welcome them now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org. Just one more beat on the question of trade and subsidies that we were pursuing right before our break. The argument you hear in the current political campaign, though, is that we have to do a better job of addressing these trade questions, because otherwise, both for environmental reasons and job reasons here in the United States, American workers are going to pay a price, and the environment is going to pay a price, because we're getting these trade items from countries who don't adhere to the same environmental and job standards that are adhered to in this country.
Let me address the worker question, because I think that's very critical. You know, if you go back in the 60s and 70s and you look at how the West explained the virtues of free market economics to the rest of the world, it said the great advantage of free market economics is that it's very dynamic, it responds to the marketplace. And as the great European economist Joseph Sampeter said, as part of capitalism, you have to have creative destruction, right? Industries that were once efficient and good become inefficient and are replaced by other industries. You can't forever preserve the horse and buggy when the motor car comes along. Now, the irony here is that most American and European politicians do not want to speak about the concept of creative destruction and do not want to explain to the American and European workers that in a global marketplace, you have to compete now globally with everybody else. And if the Chinese workers can produce textiles at a much cheaper rate, you cannot compete with them. Singapore itself gave up its textile industry because we could not compete with the Chinese and Indians. We had to move up the value ladder and go to high value added jobs to compete with China and India. I think this is what I think America and Europe will have to do too.
But how do you make that as a winning political argument? That's not an argument that you hear any of the candidates making right now.
Oh, of course. I mean, I realize that when you're campaigning for elections, you have to go to give a populist message and say, I will protect your job. But that's dishonesty, and we know that. I mean, politicians have to be dishonest. Analysts have to be honest. And if you do not have honest analysts balancing dishonest political messages, then I think we are in deep trouble.
To our calls this morning, let's begin with Richard, who joins us first in Penn Grove. Richard, go ahead.
Yes, hi, sir. I hope I'm more confused than clear about this, but what I'm hearing, what it feels like and sounds like, is that that there is an upsetment and certainly a misunderstanding through the leadership of this country. That's an understatement, if I may. And that they've been getting it wrong. And there's many of us here in this country who not only know that, but have been working very diligently to try to balance that out. My comment goes more to your future comments about it sounds as if you're saying almost the same thing that the silly fanatics in Washington are saying, but just from a different perspective. And I wondered if you would let me know if you think or believe that I am your brother and that we need to figure this out creatively together and in a sustainable way, rather than joining and getting better at the silly paradigm which now exists.
Hmm. Richard, thank you. Thanks for the call. Interesting question about sort of whether this will just reverse itself and continue to be an us against them, only with the East being the dominating force.
Well, one of the most optimistic messages I have in the book is that I say that the rest of the world doesn't want to dominate the West. It wants to replicate the West and indeed implement, as I say, the seven pillars of Western wisdom out there. What I find that most Western audiences, frankly, do not understand very well is how much the West continues to dominate the world and makes decisions on behalf of the rest of the world. And so if you're not aware in the West that you're actually sitting on top of others, you begin to wonder, why are this guy screaming? Now, what's happening now is that the people in the rest of the world were passive, saying, I want to be your brother. I want to be your equal, but don't sit on me anymore. Give me a chance to have an equal share in the running of the world. And the best case example, I give the simplest example, is that if you look at the IMF and the World Bank, the two most powerful economic organizations of the world, to become the head of the IMF, you must be a European. To become the head of the World Bank, you must be an American. And guess what? 3.5 billion Asians, who make up the vast majority of the world's population, don't qualify, even though they have the world's fastest growing economies, even though they have the world's largest reserves. Now, are you treating the Asians as your brothers, or are you treating the Asians as second-class citizens who have no equal say in the running of the world?
What are the prospects for bringing those kinds of changes about? You discuss both the IMF and the World Bank in your book and the point that you just made. Mm. You also talk about changing the United Nations, that the structure of the Security Council, for example, you argue is antiquated. Mm. Do you see prospects for bringing about those sorts of changes so that those institutions are more reflective of the way the current world is?
Yeah, I must say your question brings out a very important point that I think is worth emphasizing. It's important for all of us to be aware that we are living in one of the most plastic moments of world history today. It's the decisions that we make today that will determine the course of world history. And this is why I make this very strong message in the book that please do not resist the rise of Asia. Work with Asia. And if you can work with Asia, make them equal, responsible stakeholders, then we can have a happy outcome. But if you listen to some of the voices here who say we must resist it, then we are in for trouble.
And in the end, does that leave you feeling optimistic or pessimistic about whether or not the kinds of changes you'd like to see, whether that's in the leadership of the IMF or the World Bank or restructuring of the United Nations, take place?
On balance, I'm very optimistic. I believe that if you go to American universities, for example, and you meet all the young Asians studying down there, what kind of vision of world order do they want? They want to continue this world order. They don't want to throw it away. They're not trying to overthrow the world order. They're saying, let us share in its management.
Back to our call. Sean is next in Berkeley this morning. Sean, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I'm surprised that I haven't heard anything yet from your guest about the global situation, not on the economic front, but on the environmental front. There's a consensus among world's biologists that more than half of the world's species are on the verge of extinction within 50 years if we go on with the modern project as usual, and global warming, as you know, will lead to catastrophic destruction as well as the undermining of the very prosperity that you're talking about. So I'm wondering if your guest can say something about how he is factoring this in, because I haven't heard a word about it.
Sean, thanks. Thanks for getting us to that topic. It is an important one. It's one you do address in the book. But Sean raises a really important point, and it's well documented, the sorts of environmental concerns that are happening in China in particular.
Yeah. I'm pleased to report that the book does discuss the subject of environment and global warming. And I think many Asians are aware that we have a real problem with the situation of global warming. And I think if you ask the Chinese and Indian leaders, for example, I think they're prepared to accept responsibility in trying to reduce the new flows of greenhouse gas emissions that will come as a result of the development of China and India. But at the same time, as you know, the Chinese and Indian leaders also say, if you want a global, equitable solution to the question of global warming, you have to be concerned about the new flows of greenhouse gas emissions, but you also have to factor in the stock of greenhouse gas emissions that have been put up there by the West since the Industrial Revolution over the past 150 years. That is also the reason why we have global warming today. So if the West takes no responsibility for the stock of greenhouse gas emissions, then you cannot expect the poorer countries to make all the sacrifices without the richer countries also making their sacrifices.
But you certainly see in the EU, and you certainly see in this state in California, a recognition of those responsibilities. Is it not also fair, even though the per capita amount of emission is greater in this country, to expect that China and India, those countries really must do something, or the kinds of environmental disasters that Sean is outlining they're not only going to happen, they are happening.
Absolutely. I mean, and believe me, you will find that in my book I tell stories about how, you know, the Chinese have actually tried to restore some of their forests too. They're doing that too with their development. And the critical point here is that they're willing to be partners if the West prepares to be equal partners in the sacrifices. And a simple test, you know, Al Gore has said this, Tom Friedman has said this, why can't the United States have a dollar a gallon tax on its gasoline? Come on, that's asking very little, okay? Now, if you could do something as simple as that, you send a signal to the rest of the world, I'm prepared to make the sacrifices now, are you ready? And the answer will be yes.
So it goes back to your earlier argument. If the West is going to have, in this country in particular, some power of moral persuasion on whether it's questions of human rights or questions of the environment, it still must lead, even though you project a time when it no longer will.
Yeah, but I think because it is still very much the dominant power.
Stephen Livermore writes, I find your guest somewhat confusing about economic power and leadership. There's little doubt that the Asian economies will become larger than Western economies, but that's simply a byproduct of a large population, not leadership. Asian governments have simply adopted Western policies. When the East brings something new and good to the world, then it will be a world leader.
Well, that's a very good question, because it seems to assume that all the good in the world has come from the West. And the East has got the proof that it can also deliver good. And in that sense, it's a wonderful question. I think what you're going to see is a better world in the 21st century, because you're going to move from a mono-civilizational world where you only had one successful civilization to a multi-civilizational world. And if you look at the depth and richness of Asian cultures, if you look at what China has had in the Tang Dynasty and previous dynasties, if you look at the rich history of India, when you see a cultural renaissance in China and India and the other Asian societies, believe me, it'll be a much more interesting world and a much richer world in terms of ideas than the mono-civilizational world we've had. But to conceive of that is very difficult, because for the last 200 years, all you've had is a mono-civilizational world.
Lee Tay challenges you on another point. He says, your guest's lessons about cultural sensitivity would fall on deaf ears if he ever tried those lessons on Islamic officialdom. Indonesians' mosques have sound systems Metallica would envy, and they blare their calls to prayer and other exhortations at window-rattling volume. It's a level of cultural imperialism few Westerners would dream of imposing on others.
I'm always very glad that when questions on Islam come up, because there's a deep anxiety and fear about Islam in the West. And clearly there are many things wrong, by the way, in Islamic societies, and they have a lot to fix them in their societies. But you also have to understand why the Islamic world is so angry against the West. I mean, Iraq is part of the problem. But you look at the Middle East, for example. We all know what a solution in the Middle East is going to be like. It's Bill Clinton's formula of two states that he worked out in the Taba Accords in January 2001. Why can't the West be even-handed and implement a solution in the Middle East? Because if you did that, believe me, the Muslims would become more cooperative, and they would begin to do things that you would want them to do. And let me give a counterexample. In Singapore, for example, you have mosques everywhere, but we have persuaded the Muslims in Singapore that you got to share space with the Chinese and the Indians, and therefore the mosque no longer blares this music, and instead it is broadcast on radio that you can listen in your home. Mm-hmm. So there's a very simple technical solution.
More of our callers now. Robert, next in Bel Air, Maryland, on the Sirius Satellite Network. Robert, go ahead.
Yes. After a year in Taiwan and seeing the Asian economy up close, I became a free market libertarian activist in the United States. And I just had a question for the caller. It seems that we have divorced, unfortunately, civil rights from free market policies in the West. And I was wondering if our guest has any suggestions on how we may be able to rejuvenate that movement in the West, and to remember that those two activities, both the free market economy and civil rights, go hand in hand.
Robert, thanks.
I agree. And indeed, I explain in the book that in the long run, all societies, by the way, want to become democracies. All people in the world want to live in societies where their civil rights are respected. But here, the one controversial point I make is that the rest of the world is shocked at how much America retreated from its protection of civil liberties after 9/11. And this has been a huge shock to the rest of the world. They thought that America would always remain the strongest and the last defender of human rights. Instead, you see in the Patriot Act, you see in Guantanamo, America retreating from its own fundamental principles. I think it's important for America to go back where it stood, to continue to be the beacon on this issue as it was in the past.
Interesting emails coming in also on other connected topics. NG writes, I would agree that Deng Xiaoping brought a lot of purchasing power to the people, but I wouldn't say that that is happiness. He launched China on the road of oil, which is peaking in the 21st century. Yes, the economic pie is growing, but the engine, oil, is shrinking. Unless Asia brings a new marvelous formula based on a non-oil economy, neither China nor India has a chance to prosper, let alone dominate the world.
Yes, certainly. I mean, oil is going to be a major challenge. But on the question of Deng Xiaoping, by the way, I think the best judge of whether or not Deng Xiaoping really was a good leader or a bad leader should be the Chinese people. And there's absolutely no question that if you ask the Chinese who has done more good for them in the 20th century, they have no doubt that it was Deng Xiaoping.
But on his other point that, yes, this rise of modernity seems relentless at this point. Mm. If it's driven by oil, and we all know the problems that that entails, aren't China and India going to bump into those same questions?
They are, but I think it's very important for me to share with your listeners a sense of how these concerns come across when the Asians hear this, you know? You know what the Asians will say? If you guys in the West had been as responsible when you were developing fast, right? If you had been very careful in your management of energy resources, if you had been careful about not using too much oil, then we would say, fine, we have a role model to follow. But the West, as you know, behaved dangerously, recklessly in its initial phases of development. Suddenly, right, when China and India are beginning to develop, you're imposing much higher standards on them in their early stages of development than you impose on yourself.
It's a fair point. On the other hand, you could argue that in some ways it may not be relevant because the state of the world is the state of the world. If we are indeed in this precarious point right now, whether that's environmentally or with our depleted resources, then the fair point you make still does not negate the need for India and China to do what they must do.
Absolutely. But the 1.2 billion people living in China and the 1.1 billion people living in India say, okay, can the 300 million people living in America and the 400 million people living in Europe show us the way and demonstrate that they are prepared to make sacrifices as the richest countries of the world? Otherwise, it looks, frankly, like a completely hypocritical concern. And I think I have to emphasize that. It is amazing how insular and incestuous the Western dialogue on the state of the world is. There are billions of new voices speaking out there that the West is not listening to. And that's what my book tries to provide.
And one of the things you also suggest, is just a sort of in an oh-by-the-way kind of manner in the book, is that people in the West should travel more.
Absolutely. I mean, you really, if you want to get a sense of what optimism is all about, as your caller said, you know, when he went to Taiwan, he suddenly believed in free market libertarian economics again. And the greatest believers in free market economics are now in China and India. And frankly, I actually remain convinced that America and Europe can compete and do well in this much larger global economy. I'm optimistic.
Chuck in San Francisco, you're on.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'm not sure, just on that last point, it seems that we in the West made our innovations, like the Industrial Revolution and the modern economy. Maybe it's the developing world's turn to make some innovations in terms of figuring out an alternative to the fossil fuel-based economic drivers that got us where we are today. But first, I think one of the reasons that we believe we could invade Iraq and be welcomed by the Iraqis was we got a lot of bad information, probably bad information even more harmful than the WMD stuff, was about the reception we would receive when we got to Iraq from the Iraqi National Congress. But my question has to do with replicating the West's relations with resource-producing nations. It seems to me that if you look at Sudan, for example, China may be doing committing some of the same crimes that the West committed in our relations with oil-producing nations by supporting a brutal and repressive regime in the interest of having access to its resources. Do you think that it's correct for developing nations to replicate that aspect of the development of the West, or do you think there's a better way?
Chuck, thank you.
Very good question. First of all, I think we should all condemn what is happening in Sudan and in Darfur. And whatever the world can do to stop that from happening, we should all unite and stop it. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about that. But I think we should separate that question from the question of how much, how we get oil. And, you know, the very simple question the Chinese would ask any American is, why don't we have a standard rule that say that says that we should only buy oil from democracies? We should all stop buying oil from countries that are not democratic, okay? Can you imagine the impact on the rest of the world? If the West stops buying oil from Saudi Arabia, from Kuwait, from Qatar, from Abu Dhabi, right? So clearly, the world is obviously an imperfect place. What if you really want to improve societies, and this is the other revolutionary message in my book, okay? Do not look at where a society is today. Look at where it is going and where it is heading to tomorrow. And the reason why we should support this march to modernity is that all the societies that seem to be stuck in the past will eventually change and move forward too.
But I think Chuck's essential point was that just as the United States and the West should be held to a higher standard, should not also developing nations have those standards rather than simply replicate the mistakes that have been endemic in the West?
Yes, I think the answer would be yes, but you need to also apply them equally to everybody. You mustn't impose higher standards on the new developing countries than you imposed on yourself. And believe me, I wish I could somehow rather communicate the sentiments of a billion Chinese and a billion Indians. Because if they listen to statements like this, they get very upset, you know. They say, come on, why are you imposing higher standards on us than you imposed on yourselves in the past? Let's be fair.
I don't think Chuck was saying impose higher standards. I think he was just imposing standards. But in any event, Anu from Richmond writes, most of what I've heard this morning I agree with. However, I'm seeing one significant oversight. Among the Indians and Indian Americans I grew up with, there was a strong educational bias toward the sciences and away from humanities, such as arts and history. Students who wanted to pursue humanities were considered lesser, the social norm being to prioritize wealth and rationalism over culture or creativity. How can Asia avoid that fate?
Here, the good news is that it's clear that as Asian societies succeed, develop, master science and technology, have more successful economies, guess what? They're rediscovering their own cultures, right? I mean, there's an amazing renaissance going on in Asia that most people are unaware of, you know. Let me just mention one project. From the 5th to the 12th centuries, the Harvard of the East was a place called Nalanda University, which is now in Bihar, Orissa. Now, that died in the 12th century because of Turkic invasion. Today, and that's where the scholars from Japan, Korea, China, Southeast Asia went to study, in Nalanda University. That university has died for 800 years, and it is now being revived. Isn't that amazing? That's an example of connecting with the past that Asia could not do because it never had the resources to do so, but that's what you'll see in the 21st century. And it'll be a magical time to live in the 21st century, because we'll suddenly rediscover the great things that used to happen in Asia that were buried by two centuries of Western domination.
As we prepare for the rest of the 21st century, what is the one thing you'd most like listeners to this program, readers of your book, people in that 12% you write about, most understand, most begin to consider?
Well, I would certainly encourage them to read my book and to tell them that please do not fear the rest of the world. Remove these dark images you have of the Islamic world. Remove this fear you have of China or even the rise of Asia. These are people who want to be like you. These are people who aspire to have the kind of comfortable middle-class home you have, washing machines, flush toilets, in a car, right? This is what they want to have. Their challenge is that they have to achieve all this in a much more difficult environment. They have to worry about the global environment. So they have to exercise more responsibility as they develop. Now, they are prepared to be responsible partners of the 12% of the world's population. But the 12% of the world's population, which is much richer, much more affluent, has got to show they can take on its fair share of the sacrifices. So I'm confident that we can have a new global partnership.
Kishore Mahbubani, our guest this hour. Again, his book is called The New Asian Hemisphere, The Irresistible Shift of Global Power to the East. Kishore Mahbubani, thanks for being part of our program this morning.
Thank you very much.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Tina Lauerberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this hour, Danny Bringer. And the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.